All right, we are going to go ahead and get started. Hello, everyone. On behalf of AgriLinks, Feed the Future, and the USAID Bureau for Food Security, I would like to welcome you to our webinar on sanitary and phytosanitary issues to achieving the global food security strategy. We're going to have a great discussion today about food safety and its importance to agricultural development with two case studies on fall armyworm and aflatoxin. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a Knowledge Management and Learning Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security, and I will be your webinar facilitator today, so you'll hear my voice periodically, especially during our question and answer portions. Before we dive into the content, I'd like to go over just a couple of items to orient you to the webinar. First, please do use the chat box to introduce yourselves and let us know where you're joining from, and I can see that a lot of you have done that already. The chat box is your main way to communicate today, and we encourage you to use it to post questions, share resources, and discuss the topic with your colleagues. So don't hesitate. We're all about engagement in the chat box. We'll be collecting your questions throughout the webinar, and we'll answer some of them along the way, and the rest will hold until after the presentations. You'll see that the slides for today are available for download in the box on the left of your screen if you'd like to grab a copy, and they'll also be posted on AgriLinks. And lastly, we are recording this webinar, and we will email you the recording, the transcript, and some additional resources once they are ready, which should be in a week or perhaps 2 weeks' time. All right, well, we've got a lot of content to get through today, and I'm excited to learn about and discuss food safety. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speakers, and then we can get started. So first up will be Kelly Cormier, who is Division Chief of the Inclusive Market Development Division at the USAID Bureau for Food Security in the Office of Market and Partnership Innovation. Kelly, she leads a team that addresses access to finance, market system strengthening, risk management and resilience, agribusiness enabling environment and trade, and commercialization of technologies. That's a wide portfolio. So Kelly will be kicking us off with a short intro. And then we will move on over to Lee Gross, who is a senior program manager with the USDA Foreign Agricultural Service. And he leads the Food Safety Network, an interagency partnership between the USDA, USAID, and FDA to help build food safety capacity worldwide. And so we'll learn a little bit more about the Food Safety Network and some other broad aspects of food safety and SPS from Lee. Next up will be Chris Peterson, who is a toxicologist and entomologist, serving as a program manager and team lead for the Food Safety in Africa team at the USDA FDS Office of Capacity Building and Development. And he'll be covering a fall armyworm case study. And then we will have two speakers discussing aflatoxin. Ken Schenge, who is a plant pathologist with USDA's Agricultural Research Service with over 10 years' experience in international agriculture, plant health, food safety, and public health. And we will close up with Elisa Lothar, who is a food safety program manager with the USDA Foreign Agricultural Service and who oversees food safety and aflatoxin capacity building programs in Africa and Central America. So this is a great lineup of speakers. I'm excited, and I'm going to pass the mic over to Kelly Cormier to kick us off.
Thank you, Julie. It's a pleasure to be starting the presentation today, and I want to make a couple of key points to situate the topic in the context of the global food security strategy, and then I'll let Lee Gross take it from there. We've learned that addressing sanitary and phytosanitary, or SPS, capacity building is an important part of a strategic agricultural development approach. The global food security strategy, with its focus on market system strengthening, puts increased emphasis on plant health, animal health, and food safety, and acknowledges the contributions of this trifecta towards inclusive and sustainable ag-led economic growth, strengthened resilience, and improved nutrition, the highest level objectives for the global food security strategy. SPS system strengthening also requires an appreciation for partnership among diverse public and private stakeholders and an awareness of the unique roles and incentives that drive action for different kinds of stakeholders. USAID's Bureau for Food Security collaborates through an interagency agreement with USDA Foreign Ag Service and U.S. Food and Drug Administration on the Food Safety Network in order to leverage U.S. government technical resources to meet critical needs related to SPS system strengthening and food safety in the broadest sense. And now, over to Lee.
Thank you, Kelly. So Kelly mentioned the Food Safety Network, and I just want to make sure that everyone online today checks out our activities page on the AgriLink site. The Food Safety Network is really about what Kelly said, leveraging resources, expertise, and partnership, primarily among the U.S. government, but certainly with implementing partners. There are three major components of the Food Safety Network. The first is working with USAID missions globally to look at sanitary and phytosanitary capacity gaps in country, and really looking at the enabling environment. The second piece is focused on knowledge management, you know, components like this webinar today, but also a whole host of resources on our activities page on the AgriLink website. And then the third is a suite of online distance learning modules that we're particularly proud of, available in English, French, and Spanish. I encourage everyone to go check those out. But they're on a variety of topics, up to 14 different modules we have online right now, focused primarily on plant health, but also animal health and food safety are forthcoming. So check those out when you get a chance. So my presentation today is going to dive a little deeper and look at kind of SBS as a holistic perspective, both in the context of the global food security strategy, market systems, and value chain approach. And, you know, it's under this topic that you're only as good as your weakest link. We know that many SBS issues, you know, pests and disease are transboundary in nature. So looking at things from both a regional and a country perspective. So SBS measures protect domestic and international food supplies from before a calf is born or a seed planted and through food production and processing to products in the grocery store. It's really all about safe and nutritious food. So the SBS agreement under the World Trade Organization is essentially about health and international trade. And what we know is that international trade and travel has expanded significantly over the past 50 years. This has increased the movement of products that might pose health risks. So the SBS agreement recognizes the need for countries to protect themselves from the risks posed by the entry of pests and diseases, but also seeks to minimize any negative effects of SBS measures on trade. So the measures that WTO members apply can be classified as either sanitary, relating to human or animal life or health, or phytosanitary, relating to plant life or health. They are commonly known as SBS measures. And so the international trade aspect of the SBS agreement basically means that in seeking to protect health, WTO members must not use SBS measures that are unnecessary, not science-based or arbitrary, or which constitute a disguised restriction on international trade. You know, in looking at a systems approach to food safety, it's important to recognize that food safety is rooted in both animal and plant health and food safety monitoring. Even within the USDA, we have the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, the Food Safety Inspection Service, you know, focused at a holistic approach, with the outcome being improved human health. USAID has defined a market system as including four primary elements. So looking first at value chains, the relationship among them, and the broader support for the enabling environment in which they operate, the households and communities that are engaged indirectly or directly that are affected by these value chains. So when thinking about interconnected market systems and how they support value chains, we really need to look at the intersection of these market systems to help avoid redundancy and develop and leverage complementary project resources. So for example, increasing risk management for SBS performance overall will support a number of prioritized value chains. So too, all value chains will benefit from activities enabling the use of safe agricultural inputs and improved laboratory infrastructure. So we really think that SBS capacity building provides a lot of bang for your buck because improvement in the overall SBS system for one value chain equals improved performance for all. When thinking more broadly about the Global Food Security Strategy Results Framework, SBS systems cross across multiple projects to help achieve primarily objectives one and three of the Global Food Security Strategy, with the first focused on inclusive and sustainable agricultural-led economic growth and really safeguarding hard-won productivity gains from pests and disease outbreak. The third is really this focus on well-nourished populations, especially among women and children, and it's really about access to safe and nutritious food. So looking at cross-cutting intermediate results, there is SBS capacity building is focused on improved evidence-based policymaking as well as directly well-functioning SPS systems, which is a cross-cutting intermediate result, all of which are vital to ag development, consumer protection, and trade. Now, next, I just want to highlight SPS from kind of three entry points. And when you're thinking about your work globally, these are the entry points that a number of us come to. So food safety is a significant matter of public health importance at the global level. It is the focus of growing attention as global food trade increases and new agricultural food technologies emerge, eating patterns change, and new microbial pathogens surface. So morbidity due to poor food safety laws lowers quality of life and reduces economic productivity, with developing countries being especially affected. So a particular concern are microbial contaminants, mycotoxins, and chemical contaminants such as aflatoxin, which you'll hear a little bit more about today. The foodborne microbial contaminants cause illness in up to one-third of the world's population each year, according to the World Health Organization estimates. Of those affected, 420,000 die. These figures are on par with death rates annually from malaria. However, what we know is that globally, investments in other public health issues like malaria and tuberculosis, food safety investments are really quite low. So there's a need for countries to prioritize food safety issues and capacity within their countries, both from a public health standpoint and a sustainable development perspective. Next entry point is really thinking about the role of SPS in nutrition. And this is a priority. Food safety is one of the six technical areas under the new U.S. government Global Nutrition Coordination Plan. And many U.S. government-supported health and food security programs seek to strengthen food safety systems writ large or to improve household food safety practices, including food handling, hygiene, and at-home food storage. So through this coordination plan, the U.S. government commits to collaborating on food safety programs, sharing food safety expertise and education materials to meet the following goals: reducing illness due to unsafe food, reducing exposure to mycotoxins, and working with countries in strengthening their national food safety regulatory frameworks. The next entry point is thinking is through a trade lens, and with the Foreign Agriculture Service, this is a as an export promotion agency, this is a topic that we work and think about a lot. But we know that there are benefits to extremely poor households, both directly and indirectly from trade, through improved market access for their products, increased employment opportunities, as well as access to affordable, high-quality food, medicines, and other consumer goods that are critical to the poor. However, modern and reliable food safety systems are becoming a mandatory prerequisite for a country's access to global markets. And however, while food safety standards and regulations around the world are converging on a preventative controls approach, a myriad of private standards and multiple government regulations are not harmonized. So many developing countries' exporters struggle to integrate compatible food safety systems and global supply chains, while some smallholders also struggle to meet these new requirements. We know that for more than a decade, the largest importers and retailers in developing countries have been requiring their suppliers to comply with domestic food safety regulations such as ISO 22000 or Global GAP. And then since 2004, the European Union with Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point, or HACCP, principles. And then more recently, something to be aware of is certainly the implementation of the U.S. Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA. Beginning in 2017, the U.S. importers must begin verifying that their foreign suppliers are implementing certain preventative controls in their food safety plans. So globally, from both an access and a trade perspective, it's important that countries are investing in these SPS systems and in the harmonization of trade standards based on science-based principles. So next, I want to orient people around kind of looking at in your agricultural value chain programming. If we think back to the market systems approach and where key investments can be made, but thinking about SPS issues within these value chains. So the more steps in a value chain from production, harvest, storage, preparation, shipping, the greater risk that food is contaminated or spoiled. And additionally, the longer the chain, the more vulnerable to shocks of climate, energy costs, food safety, phytosanitary problems, corruption, social political unrest, as well as policy constraints such as interstate and international tariff and non-tariff trade barriers. So the food safety challenge is magnified in an unstable value chain and when the share of perishable and animal source foods in total food grows. Food safety hazards can occur all along the value chain. So generally they can be described as microbiological, so mycotoxins, bacteria, infectious pathogens, chemical, pesticides, fertilizer, veterinary drugs, and counterfeits, or physical, heavy metals, pests, plant and animal diseases, poor production, bureaucratic processes leading to commodity aging or decay, transportation, container integrity, or ineffective regulatory environment. So, for example, something that happens at input level will ripple through the whole chain and may have a negative impact on consumer health or trade. So in looking at a risk mitigation strategy for SPS issues, we need to think about preventative control points along the value chain and where critical investments can be made, whether that's at a regulatory level through policy, a physical infrastructure level with laboratory investments in laboratories, or integration of best practice production process and handling. About your development activities, and we're continuing with the case studies today, you'll be able to see kind of where hazards exist within a value chain and the strategic interventions that the projects have taken to kind of mitigate that risk. So in conclusion, SPS systems are complex and cross-cutting, and we really feel that they're both a necessary and integral part of agricultural value chain investment strategy. So as a country's agricultural sector achieves greater production efficiencies and improved physical infrastructure, food yields and domestic food security will increase. But they require a high degree of coordination from regional government bodies, national governments, private sector entities, U.S. government and other donors and implementers to work collaboratively to have true impact. So we look forward to continuing the discussion through the two case studies today and looking at overall how you're strengthening SPS systems in your agricultural value chain work. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Lee. To all of you who are joining us today, please do feel free to enter your questions at any time. We'll be asking some or answering some along the way, and we'll also hold some to the end of the presentation. And also please feel free to share your direct experiences that you have with working for food safety in the field and if you've observed any particular hazards that you'd like to bring up and share with your colleagues. But for now, I think we're going to go ahead and move on to Chris Peterson for a case study on fall armyworm.
Okay. Thank you, Julie, and thank you, everybody, for joining the webinar today. And so I'll be presenting the results of a case study in Zambia, where I was able to spend 2 weeks on the ground in Lusaka and interviewed as many people as I possibly could to see the scope and the extent of the problem. And the objective of about the next 10 slides or so is to show how the control of one pest can intersect with the SPS framework that Lee presented. If you recall the S-shaped graph that he showed a few slides ago, this one pest intersects at many of those different areas. So, and my slide is not, there it goes. So fall armyworm is recently introduced to Africa, and it's been devastating. The FAO provides crop damage estimates, which reach into the billions of dollars continent-wide. And in heavily infested fields, it can completely eliminate the entire crop. We have this pest in the United States, but it's not as much of a problem, A, because it's native to the United States, but also in the winter it gets killed by the cold temperatures. In Africa, that's not the case, and so the African climate permits a continuous life cycle of this pest. And we've found that anywhere and any time corn is actively growing, fall armyworm is present as well and causing damage. Now, most of the attention has been to the maize crop, but there's other strains that attack rice, and overall, over 80 different plants can be affected, which causes a lot of considerations for management, because to control this pest in an integrated fashion, it's going to need to be equal attention is going to need to be paid to all of the crops and even the non-crop plants that this pest infests. Now, so I'm not going to talk too much today about how to kill fall armyworms. There's an excellent booklet put together by USAID and Feed the Future on fall armyworm, and the link is provided on this slide here, and I see Julie's just posted it into the chat box. So please feel free to download that booklet and make use of it. It's very, very thorough, very well researched, and will provide answers to most of your questions on fall armyworm management. As I mentioned, I'm going to be speaking today more about the intersection of the management of this pest to the overall SPS systems. Now, as I mentioned, the fall armyworm is native to the Western Hemisphere. We're not exactly sure how it got to Africa. It's a very strong flyer, but it's not able to cross the Atlantic Ocean, so it had to come in somehow through shipping, either by sea or by air. And the port inspections at the ports that received our products from the Western Hemisphere were unable to, or they did not stop this pest from getting into Africa. But once it got to Africa, it had virtually unopposed access across all of sub-Saharan Africa. There was just no natural barriers that were able to slow its spread. And so it was first detected in January of 2016 in Nigeria. It was probably there longer. They just didn't know what they had. But then about 2 years later, virtually all of sub-Saharan Africa was reporting fall armyworm. And so in Zambia specifically, where, as I mentioned, I spent a couple weeks looking in depth at the problem, is that fall armyworm was first detected there in late 2016. In the first year, they reported about 130,000 hectares infested. By the second year, it was about 2.5 times that, almost 3 times that, as far as hectares infested. It just has a very quick life cycle and is very good at spreading around the world and making more of itself. This overwhelmed the government resources from the Ministry of Agriculture, and the Office of the Vice President in Zambia issued an emergency declaration that allowed access to a contingency fund to respond to emergencies such as this. The funds from that contingency fund were used to purchase pesticide rescue treatments and to distribute seed for free to farmers that were affected. However, that first growing season was half over before they even conclusively identified that it was the fall armyworm. And so, unfortunately, it was too late for many farmers to save their crop from this pest that first year. And so the second growing season, which just concluded in the last few months, people generally acknowledge that the response to the fall armyworm was better than it was the first year. They knew what pests they had. They were able to utilize resources to better control it. But also, people across the board, from NGOs and the private sector and the government, developed and distributed educational materials, some of it very technical for the large-scale commercial farmers. Some of it was for smallholder farmers that were based mostly on pictures with minimal text, and in some cases the text was presented in the local language to educate farmers on how to respond to this pest. There was also mass media and social media campaigns that got the word out very quickly and very effectively. When I was there, we were talking to taxi cab drivers and servers at restaurants, asking them about fall armyworm, and they all knew what it was. They all had pretty good information about the extent of the damage. So the public was educated very quickly and very effectively. There's a lot of pest monitoring going on around the country, primarily from pheromone traps to determine the extent and the breadth and the depth of the problem. And so we have a lot of data there. Unfortunately, there's just not much of a mechanism to do anything with the data. We've got all these numbers. What do we do with them now that we got it? But also, having two growing seasons, we know more about the products that are effective in controlling the pest. Some of the initial recommendations the Ministry of Agriculture presented just weren't effective, but with experience, they were able to determine which ones had the best the best chance. But we did, so despite a lot of these successes, we did identify several gaps that remain in responding to the issue. First of all, the extension services to reach farmers and provide information are understaffed and underfunded. An individual extension agent is has under his or her geographic area about two or three times the number of individual farmers that would be effective for that person to have. Also, these extension agents receive virtually no budget to go and visit these farmers in the farmer groups. In some cases, they don't even have funding for internet access, and so they're not even able to receive some of the materials that are out there. Pesticides have been the go-to solution for fall armyworm. There's a lot of research into integrated techniques, but pesticides for now remains the most effective and the most commonly used. But pesticide regulation remains weak. And as is common throughout throughout Africa and most of the developing world, is that substandard, counterfeit, and contaminated products are very common in the market. And at best, you know, these substandard products, for whatever reason, just aren't effective. And so yields are being reduced, and that represents lost food and increased food insecurity. But also, the presence of any contaminants introduces a food safety risk by people consuming food with residues of prohibited pesticides or just even like industrial contaminants of some sort that shouldn't be in the food. But also, there's only a few products that are being used widely. And when that happens, the stage is set for the development of insecticide resistance. And so everybody we talk to is concerned that within 3 to 5 years, most of the products that we're currently using for fall armyworm won't be effective anymore just because of the development of resistance. But unfortunately, getting new products into that part of the world can be a very slow process that doesn't always work as well as we would like it to. We also noticed a significant gap in multi-sectoral communication and coordination of information and control efforts. First of all, the Zambian government does not have a permanent body with a mandate to address emerging or ongoing issues. There's a lot of one-off task forces and early warning groups and various ad hoc, and one person even used the term ad-hocracy, which I love that term, and it's very descriptive anyway of how things tend to respond. But with between all these different groups for different pests, there's very little communication between the different groups and no ability to capitalize on lessons learned from one issue to the next. And we've also found that cooperation with NGOs, the private sector, universities, and the regional authorities, such as the South African Development Community or Southern Africa Development Community, tends to be very spotty. In some cases, certain efforts are very successful in two or three districts, but are not being replicated across the country, or they only reach certain farmers in other cases, such as a community-based organization that works with smallholder farmers isn't reaching the emerging or the mid-range farmers. And so a nationwide coordinated effort is lacking. We also took a look at the inspection facilities at one of the 8 land borders that Zambia has with its neighbors and at the airport in Lusaka. And what we found is that overall, the inspections are being done by properly qualified people using appropriate techniques. However, there's just not enough of them. And if the fall armyworm were to leave Zambia or any African country in a shipment such as snap peas here in the picture, that could introduce fall armyworm to the Middle East, Europe, or Asia. And it would just use Africa as a stepping stone to other parts of the world. That also leaves Zambian exporters vulnerable to import bans if the presence of fall armyworm in shipments became a recurring problem. Certain countries could simply refuse to accept any shipments from Zambia at all. and also the improper use of pesticides or the use of contaminated products could introduce residues into those shipments that, again, if it became a recurring problem, could result in an import ban of Zambian products into these other countries, which directly affects the value chain and goes all the way down to the individual farmers producing. So the top takeaways from the Zambian experience is that fall armyworm continues to be a problem and will be for the foreseeable future. Zambia doesn't have a permanent body to respond to such issues, and the extension and public outreach efforts are underfunded and uncoordinated. The fourth takeaway, the ability of and management of pest control tools, could be an entire webinar in its own. There's a lot of issues there, but just for now, it's sufficient to say that it remains a challenge. But on the good side, there is very high awareness and engagement towards working to a solution. Everybody's taking this problem seriously. Everybody wants a solution, and everybody's giving what they can to make this happen. And then there's a lot of ongoing research and lessons learned to address the problem. The third growing season for fall armyworm, they'll begin planting in about November, December, and hopefully by then some of these new tools will be online and we'll be able to better control the pest for the coming growing season.
Great. Thank you so much, Chris. Well, I think there's just a lot to take in, and I think naturally some of the questions that came in during your presentation were about what can we do about all of this, and I thought it was interesting that Frank Owusu Sekeyere gave his specific example from Ghana, saying that he was very concerned with insecticides because they're having a major problem with this in Ghana. The insecticide introduced by the agricultural ministry is not working, and some imported ones are very expensive for the farmers to buy. So I think you mentioned that pesticide regulation remains weak, but to the extent that you can, shed a little bit of light on what can be done about this.
Wow. If I had a really quick answer to that, I would probably be a very famous person. unfortunately, the problem with pesticide management is it's going to require a multi-pronged approach. Everything from market forces to get better products into these countries. Unfortunately, the pesticide manufacturers sometimes see individual African countries as too small of a market to justify developing a product. So that would need to be addressed. Also, what would need to be addressed is efforts to better regulate, such as quality assurance of the pesticides entering the country, as well as education, not just of the farmers, but I believe also of the entire value chain, for there to be an incentive for farmers to comply with best practices. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take a lot of different efforts that all together will add up to a better response.
Can I add to that just to say that it's important to know that ECOWAS, the regional commission in West Africa, is actually working on this very issue to harmonize even use of pesticides across the region, but also has a phytosanitary task force that's looked specifically at fall armyworm from a regional perspective. And so it's countries need to be doing their part, but also these pests can travel across borders. So in terms of regional coordination, it's also very important, but to know that West Africa is working on it.
Mm-hmm. And just something that I'm aware of is that the fall armyworm test team in the USA Bureau for Food Security is planning to hold some webinars within a couple of months' time, specifically looking at integrated pest management and pesticides related to fall armyworm. Those aren't announced yet or fully planned, but hopefully there will be more opportunities to have conversations digging into those issues a bit more deeply. I thought I'd bring up a question from Keith Shannon, who says, in terms of multi-sectoral communication, do you think that FAO could play a coordinating role among the different sectors? If not, who else might you suggest to play a coordinating role? How do we have this broad communication between multiple sectors working on fall armyworm?
Well, FAO has been involved continent-wide and has been very active, and so I certainly didn't intend to overlook, you know, their role in regional communication. One of the issues that we find, and not just with fall armyworm, but with any regional effort, is that a lot of times those things tend to break down at the level of domesticating whatever regional approaches there are. Sometimes these countries, and I'm not saying, you know, Zambia specifically, but on certain issues, certain countries just simply don't have the capacity to implement something that's coordinated regionally. And so when we, so getting into Zambia, looking at them not having a permanent body, for example, that could respond to this, it certainly becomes a question of who takes responsibility for local implementation, national implementation of something that FAO might be coordinating on a Southern Africa regional or even continent-wide basis.
Excellent. And then, let's see, this is just a very quick one. You may not have the exact answer, but one person did ask if you know which insecticides were distributed by the Zambian government in your example.
I have that information not with me. There were a few neonicotinoids that had some effectiveness. The pyrethroids, they found some effectiveness, especially as a preventive. I know that BT powder, which is a biopesticide and certified organic, is available. One of the pictures that I showed was of a product that is based on BT powder. So there's a number of them. The Ministry of Agriculture website has a two-page trifold pamphlet that provides a list of the pesticides that they recommended.
Great. And I'll just ask one more question for now before we move on. I thought it was interesting. William Stewart asked kind of a blunt question. Would country self-sufficiency reduce the spread of fall armyworm? Maybe you could mention what country self-sufficiency means.
Okay.
And that might be something we could mention. You know, how does country self-sufficiency relate to food safety hazard spreads?
So if I understand self-sufficiency correctly, is that, you know, a country being able to produce all of the food that it needs and then lower its reliance on imports. So first of all, fall armyworm is a very strong flyer. In the United States, it can only spend the winter in southern Texas and Florida. So when the temperatures warm up in March, April, fall armyworm begins flying in the United States. It can be into the Dakotas and southern Alberta by September. So when you're looking at, especially looking at the map as I am right now of West Africa, you know, you've got 15 countries within that same distance that fall armyworm is able to spread within 3 or 4 months. And so import-export, even though that's how fall armyworm got to Africa, its ability to move within Africa, you know, doesn't depend on human activities to move it around. And one final bit of evidence on that is they in Zambia, they are looking for fall armyworm coming into the country on shipments. They have yet to find it on a shipment of agricultural products entering Zambia, which means it's coming in on its own. It's, you know, it's flying across a 100-yard wide river rather than in a shipping pallet.
Just to add to that, it was really good. You know, the title of my presentation was "You're Only as Good as Your Weakest Link." And I think, you know, and we've given this, you know, presentation with regional commissions within Africa and trying to understand that countries need to build a basic SPS system. They don't need an advanced model yet, like the U.S., even though that's the end objective. But it's really weak overall SPS systems that enable specific pest and disease outbreaks like what we're seeing with either aflatoxin or fall armyworm. So the idea is that within a region or a continent, that countries get at least a basic system in place that benefits primarily their own consumers and their own producers, and then next helps them participate in international trade.
That's a very good point. All right. In the interest of time, I think we'll move on. We can circle back to fall armyworm as some more questions come in. But we will open the floor for Ken Shengi with the USDA Agricultural Research Service to focus on a case study on aflatoxin biocontrol. So Ken, please unmute and take it away.
Thank you, Julie. I hope everyone can hear me. So this morning I'll be talking about aflatoxin biocontrol. Aflatoxins are a public health problem. They are also a problem for food safety, global food security, as well as for trade, because it's a technical barrier to trade. So the subject of aflatoxins ties in very well with the presentation that Lee gave at the beginning of this webinar. And in the next few slides, I'll be focusing on how by using biocontrol strategies to control aflatoxins helps to promote global food security and food safety in general. So throughout warm regions of the world, staple foods become contaminated with aflatoxins. And why do we care? Why do we care about aflatoxins, and why are we talking about them? The simple answer is that aflatoxins are deadly poisons. And naturally occurring mixes of aflatoxins are classified as a group 1 carcinogen. They've been proven to cause cancer in humans and animals. Just to highlight that point, an aflatoxin B1 dose of just 20 parts per billion of a person's body weight per day will probably kill a person. So taking a very high amount of aflatoxins in a short amount of time over a period of 1 to 3 weeks causes acute and potentially deadly aflatoxin poisoning called aflatoxicosis. So if people take small amounts of aflatoxins at a time, but over a long period of time, then they become exposed to small amounts of aflatoxins at a time, but over a long period of time, that leads to a situation described as chronic aflatoxicosis. Next slide, please. So how serious and how widespread is this problem? In terms of occurrence, can we go back a slide? Thank you. So in terms of occurrence, the most significant area affected is between 35 degrees north and south of the equator, and the so-called aflatoxin belt. And in terms of magnitude of exposure, it varies widely across the world. Some regions of the world, like in the aflatoxin belt, are more.
Adam, I thought you were going to advance your own slides like we did in the practice, but that's okay. Because we're trying to make sure that we're on the right side that you want, if you could just do your best to kind of look at the computer, and whenever we do advance the slide, if you could just read the title of the slide, say aflatoxins on crops or what have you, just to make sure, just say yes, that's the right slide. So is this the right slide right now?
Yes, it is. In the meantime, I will try to move the slide and see that, yes, I think it works. Okay, I think I can move the slide myself. Thank you, Adam.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, so I was talking about exposure for people, and the point I was making is that it varies globally, but in the developing world, like in those three continents in the aflatoxin belt, it's not uncommon to find 30% of the staple foods available for people being contaminated with aflatoxins beyond acceptable limits. And most of the crops that are susceptible to contamination with aflatoxins include maize and groundnuts. And again, like in Africa and South and Central America, maize is a major staple for a majority of the people there. And that's the region, a region that is home to almost two-thirds of the world's population. So you're looking at a large proportion of the global population having an exposure to aflatoxin levels that are beyond acceptable limits. Now, people can become exposed in a variety of ways, but primarily dietary intake is the most common source of exposure. And contamination starts in the field during the crop growth phase after the fungi that produce aflatoxins invade the crop under favorable environmental conditions. And once they settle in, they produce aflatoxins. And after the crops are harvested and taken into the store, aflatoxins accumulate under warm and humid conditions, especially if the crops have not been dried properly. And if contaminated food is processed, then aflatoxins enter the general food supply, where they could end up in livestock feed, in pet food, or in human food. And on this slide, I will just very briefly talk about the strategies that are available for preventing aflatoxin contamination of food, or preventing contaminated food from getting into the supply system. And the approaches that are available are focused on either preventing the toxin from getting to the crop. Those would include biocontrol, but others such as storage practices and breeding are also important. But there are also strategies for dealing with contamination after it's already occurred on the produce. And of course, at that point, we can only adopt a strategy that aims to prevent contamination from entering the food system. And under secondary prevention measures, hand sorting, for example, would be one of them, and detoxification approaches as well as destruction. But at the tertiary level, we can also talk about regulation, which is like our final line of defense against aflatoxin contamination. And obviously, considering the implication of aflatoxin contamination to health, to global trade, and to food safety, more than 100 countries have regulations that limit the maximum allowable amounts of aflatoxins in foods and feeds. In the United States, it's not allowed for any food to have more than 20 parts per billion of aflatoxins. It's much lower for milk. So in this talk, I'll be focusing on biocontrol because it has proven efficacy against aflatoxin control. And comparing all of the aflatoxin prevention approaches that I've highlighted here, it is the cheapest and most effective in terms of scale of adoption, in terms of area of application, in terms of proven efficacy, and for controlling aflatoxins in maize and groundnuts. The strategy utilizes an atoxigenic fungi to displace strains of Aspergillus that produce aflatoxins on crops. And through the use of this strategy, aflatoxin contamination in crops is reduced by up to 96%. I'm not going to spend much time on this slide. I apologize that the text is not in place, but it just shows how the results of our field trials, where we applied treatments of biocontrol, was some of our biocontrols, and we had about 92% displacement of toxin producers with the atoxigenic strain. So on this slide, I just want to highlight a brief history of success, showing that use of atoxigenics to control aflatoxins is a very rare example of where biocontrol has actually worked in nature, especially on the scale we are talking about, on a global scale. And starting from the first commercial fields treatments in 1996, the biocontrol technology has been successful in North Africa, in North America, in Africa, as well as in Europe. And currently, well over 1 million acres are treated every year with biocontrol treatments with very excellent reductions in aflatoxin contamination. Currently, the emphasis is to increase the genetics available for biocontrol by increasing the number of active ingredients in registered products. Current registered products generally contain from 1 to 4 atoxigenic genotypes. The AflaSafe biocontrol products, for example, that are targeted at countries in Africa contain 4 genotypes each. And these products are already registered for use in Nigeria, in Kenya, in Ghana, in Senegal, and Burkina Faso. I'm sure Elisa will speak more about this shortly. But just to say that the biocontrol products are very effective everywhere they're used, and this improves food security across the world and improves the safety of the environment as well, because if you have toxin producers in the environment, people can inhale them and become sick as well. So I'll just end with a few recommendations for, because I know there's some of us asking, what can I do? I'm hearing about this thing, what's the role for me? One of the recommendations, of course, is that help with aflatoxin biocontrol technology transfer is always welcome. I'm sure Elisa will also talk about this, because after the product has been developed, it has to then be taken to the areas of application and the technology has to be transferred. And the next one I will briefly talk about is gaps. Of course, the gaps continue to be a very important part of the strategy for controlling aflatoxins, especially because the problem starts in the field. Another thing is incentivization programs like what we have in Nigeria, where the AgResults program is providing an incentivized payment to growers for adoption. It has been very helpful to adoption of this technology. And capacity building in SPS in general is a very necessary component of the strategy for controlling aflatoxins. I have on this slide, the website to our lab, we have materials there, protocols, publications, and other things that people might find useful. So you're welcome to take a look on the website. And with that, I'll end the presentation. Over to you, Julie.